It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So Bodhidharma, the first patriarch of Soto Zen Buddhism, brought the Bodhisattva precept lineage to China from India. And these are the 16 great Bodhisattva precepts, the three refuges, the three pure precepts, and the 10 grave precepts. His rendition of the 10 grave precepts, which are our moral and ethical codes, are unique in their very bold alignment with ultimate truth. And so as we sit with his words, we can easily hear a huge chasm of reality that underlies them. So this series entitled Bodhisattva Precepts will first introduce Bodhidharma precepts, will first introduce Bodhidharma. He has said to have sat in a cave and done Zazen for 9 years. And then we'll compare his compassionate and liberating meaning of the 10 grave precepts, a meaning that is beyond doing and not doing, with the conventional or literal meaning, what to do and what not to do, that we've already studied. I hope that we'll find our practice of the precepts deepened and informed by Bodhidharma's words. But first, I want to remind you of how it is said that we should listen to the Dharma, which is in a state of great joy and happiness because of our amazing good fortune to be in the presence of the Dharma. Some extremely important things are so apparent that their specialness is easy to forget. For example, that we're human beings. And it's said in Buddhism that to be born as a human being is as difficult as it would be for a turtle in the middle of the ocean to come up for air in the middle of an inner tube. So what is the specialness? It's that the human being is the only incarnation that can attain enlightenment. That's why it's so important to be practicing Buddhism. The six possible incarnations, by the way, from the lowest to the highest, are the hell realms, then the hungry ghosts, then animals, then the human beings, fighting gods, and then gods. Those are the six possible, but the human being is the only one who can attain enlightenment. So another example of things being so apparent that we forget their specialness is that we're here listening to the Dharma. First, the incredible fact that the Buddha Dharma is still here, like it's here in the West. Think of the kindness of all of the teachers, the translators, the students, who all of their dedication that was necessary to bring these teachings here. And the thanks to Zoom, we can partake of them in our pajamas. But the downside is that because of this, we could easily think of the Dharma, take it for granted, and listen to it as if we're, you know, watching Netflix in bed or something. But the Dharma is not Netflix. It's a vital and unsurpassable and deserves our entire single-minded, wholehearted attention. And not just deserves, it must have our entire single-minded, wholehearted attention, or we'll miss the sweetness of its subtlety. That said, nothing else is required. One need not understand or remember or agree. The Dharma has its own methods for penetrating thick human body minds like face creams. It soaks in best while we sleep. That's the truth. You know, we actually learn. We go through our day and we sort of learn things, and we really learn while we're sleeping. That's why it's best not to pull an all-nighter. If you would have just slept, you'd probably have learned more. Anyway, but on this note of honoring the Dharma, it's important to, aside from Bodhidharma, there were other people involved in bringing us the precept lineage. And I want to review those, pay homage, and I'm going to borrow Tenshin Roshi's list because I find it so moving. So, homage to our great original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, the source of the Bodhisattva precepts. Homage to the radical liberator, Bodhidharma, who brought our Bodhisattva precept lineage from India to China. Then homage to our lofty ancestor of eternal peace, Ehe Dogen, who expressed the essential meaning of the precepts in his essay on teaching and conferring the precepts. Then homage to Ehe Dogen's great disciples, the priests Sene and Kyogo, who produced Essence of Zen Precepts, a text presenting their teacher Dogen, their teacher's deep meaning in the vast context of Indra's net, which means in the context of the interconnectedness of all beings, or in the context of ultimate truth. Homage to the compassionate scholar monk Bajin Dotan, who rediscovered the essence of Zen precepts and republished the light of the precepts for later generations. Apparently this text was so first there was Dogen, and then there was the interpretation of Dogen, and that was lost, and then it was rediscovered and republished so that we can have it by Bajin Dotan. Then homage to the whole lineage of Buddha ancestors who have received, practiced, and transmitted these precepts for the welfare of the whole world. And then lastly, homage to our compassionate founder in the United States, Shogaku Shunryu, which is Suzuki Roshi, who first conveyed the Bodhisattva precepts to me. This is Reb. And then I want to say to me also, I received from Suzuki Roshi the Bodhisattva precepts. So basically, Reb is saying that until these two priests, Sene and Kyogo, wrote the essay of Zen precepts, which explained Dogen's intended meaning, but over the centuries, this text was lost and then found, And then in order to have it in English, Reb himself translated it. And until then, we didn't understand that there were two meanings to the precepts. There's the ultimate truth meaning that is beyond the understanding of our ordinary mind, and the literal conventional meaning, which we can use in our everyday lives. But situating the precepts in this much broader framework vastly softens and enriches our potential relationship with them. So, and in addition, Reb says, paying homage to this succession of bodhisattvas and ancestors, we not only praise them and ask for their support, we also make a gesture of commitment to follow their way. We align ourselves with the path of understanding and compassion that these ancient ones followed. In this way, we vow to become bodhisattvas. So I'm about to share with you several outlandish stories surrounding Bodhidharma. But before I do, I want you to hear this rule of studying Zen that John R. McCrae, a friend of Okamura Roshi's, devised. So he's got four rules of studying Zen, and only the first one applies to us, but it definitely applies. And the rule is, when it's things that are not true are more important. Things that are not true, think about that. Things that are not true are more important. So I'm about to tell you everything that I'm going to say from here till a certain later point in this talk is not true. So here we go. This is a story surrounding Bodhidharma that John McCrae is telling. So after sailing for 3 years, imagine, Bodhidharma arrived at Nanhai, which is pronounced Guangzhou in Chinese. I'm not sure. The date was the 21st of the ninth lunar month of the year 527. So we're in 527 now. The governor of Guangzhou, named Shang Anju, received him ceremoniously and made his arrival known to Emperor Wu. When the emperor learned of this report, he dispatched an invitation for Bodhidharma to come to the capital, Nanjing. On the first day of the 10th lunar month of 528, Bodhidharma arrived in Nanjing. Okay, so the emperor spoke to him as follows. Since I've assumed the throne, I've built temples and written about scriptures, plus I've brought about the ordination of an incalculable number of monks. What merit does this activity have? Bodhidharma, no merit whatsoever. The emperor, why does this have no merit? Bodhidharma, these are matters of small consequence in the affairs of men and gods that are caused by transgression or outflows. It's like shadows chasing form. Although it's there, it's not real. The emperor, what is genuine merit? Bodhidharma, pure wisdom of sublime perfection, experiencing one's personal solitary emptiness, seeking nothing in the world. The emperor, what is the first principle of holy truth? Bodhidharma, across the vastness, nothing holy. The emperor, who is facing me? Bodhidharma, I don't know. So that's a very famous interchange. And I'm going to stop for a second and telling the stories and tell you a little about who is Emperor Wu now. So according to Chinese Buddhist tradition, shortly after gaining power, Emperor Wu embraced Buddhism, partly because his wife, who had recently died, appeared to him in a dream in the body of a large snake. From the dream, she explained that she had undergone rebirth in a snake's body because of her sins during her life. She begged the emperor to help her escape her fate by appealing to the Buddha for help on her behalf. Emperor Wu ordered the creation and observance of a ceremony to try and save his wife, but not stopping there, he also devised a ceremony called Water and Land Liberation Ceremony that appealed to beings in the upper realms of existence, such as humans, bodhisattvas, and gods, to help beings in the lower realms of existence, such as hungry ghosts, hell dwellers, and animals, and even demons. And this ceremony is still performed in Buddhist temples throughout China every year. Emperor Wu himself authored much of the liturgy used in these ceremonies, and eminent Buddhist monks of his day organized and carried them out with Emperor Wu's participation. According to legend, his wife thereupon escaped from her rebirth as a snake, and Emperor Wu's devotion to Buddhism became even stronger in the years that followed. So that's the story. And furthermore, Emperor Wu's rule, in his rule, which is said to be 502 to 549, he embraced vegetarianism, began to practice celibacy. He studied Buddhist scriptures in depth. In the year 519, at a ceremony on his palace complex, he formally took the vows of a Buddhist monk and gave up his position as emperor. Soon, however, the country's aristocracy paid ransom to make him return to his position leading the country. Imagine that. He was such a good emperor. They ransomed him back from being a monk. So when the Emperor Wu formally became a home leaver, which is what a Buddhist monk is called, four times during his long reign, but returned to become emperor after a short period each time. So he kept returning to being a monk, and then the people ransomed him back to being their leader. So he must have been an incredible leader. In his devotion to the study and expounding of Buddhist scriptures and doctrine, he spent much time that he might have otherwise been governing the country. And old records indicate that he slept on a simple mat in a plain room inside his palace, where he spent long hours studying Buddhist texts and comprising his own commentaries on their contents. He built ordination platforms where members of the aristocracy, along with the general public, together received the bodhisattva precepts in vast public assemblies. He devoutly studied the Prajnaparamita Sutra and paid special attention to the Lotus and Nirvana Sutras. So I just want to add that in Buddhism, there are kind of two main streams of development. There's wisdom and merit. And the former, wisdom, is like a deep understanding of reality, really having your own personal experience of the interconnectedness of all beings through Zazen. That's the wisdom side. And then the latter is like good works. And so my reading of this story is that Bodhidharma, who was intent on bringing Zazen and the precept lineage to China, saw that Emperor Wu, though he accomplished a lot on the merit side, was really totally lacking in the wisdom side, which is what Bodhidharma was all about. So, and at the time, Zazen was hardly practiced in China, if at all. So, I mean, Bodhidharma really brought that. And so when it said that Bodhidharma sat for 9 years in a cave, the cave was near a large monastery, Shaolin Temple. But he sat in a cave because if he had been in the monastery, he wouldn't have been able to sit Zazen. So he kind of like was a maverick. He just went to a cave near the monastery and sat facing a wall for 9 years. So that was like his life's work. Here's another version of the Bodhidharma story. So Bodhidharma, a Brahmin from southern India, arrived in South China during the Liao Song dynasty. That's before 489. So this is a little different. And at the end of his life, he again traveled to live under the Wei dynasty in North China. In various places in a book called Continued Biographies, it's evident that he avoided contact. Now, this text says he totally avoided contact with the Chinese emperors. It said that Bodhidharma's followers were numerous, like a city, but emperors were unable to attract him to give lectures at their court. Let's see. So some missionary monks from India did seek imperial patronage, but there's no evidence that Bodhidharma did. And during his time, China was divided between two competing dynasties, the Wei dynasty in the north, and in the south, there was the Song, Qi, and the Liang dynasty. But emperors of these kingdoms were avowedly Buddhist, spending a lot of money to support Buddhism. And in a country that was freezing cold, the need for support to build Buddhist monasteries was really important. But there's no evidence that Bodhidharma sought that out. And all the evidence says that he spent much time preaching and practicing among peaks and caves. So here's another story about the end of his stay in China. This is very famous. So according to tradition, Bodhidharma gathered at least four principal disciples. Hui Ke, remembered as the second ancestor, received mind-to-mind transmission that passed in turn to later Zen generations. He's the one who stood in the snow all night. We talked about him in a previous talk. He just stood in the snow all night, and then I think he cut off his arm to show his dedication. Here's the traditional story of when Bodhidharma was about to leave. So after 9 years, Bodhidharma wanted to return to India. Calling together his disciples, he said, "The time for me to return to India is at hand. Can each of you say something to demonstrate your understanding?" A disciple named Dao Fu said, "As I see it, it's not bound by words and phrases, nor is it separate from words and phrases. This is the function of Tao." Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my skin." The nun Zong Chi said, "According to my understanding, it is like a glorious glimpse of the realm of Akshobhya Buddha. Seen once, it need not be seen again." Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my flesh." A disciple named Dao Yu said, "The four elements are all empty and the five skandhas are without actual existence. As I see it, there is not a single dharma to be grasped." Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my bones." Thereupon, Hui Ke bowed and stood up straight. Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my marrow." So many interpret this dialogue to mean that only Hui Ke received the real approval and transmission from Bodhidharma because he didn't use words. And words are just not vessels of truth in Buddhism. So this understanding makes sense. But Dogen definitely disagrees. He says that all of them equally received Bodhidharma's stamp. One cannot distinguish the flesh, the skin, the bones, and marrow of Bodhidharma's complete and perfect enlightenment. That's what Dogen says. Okay, and finally, the account of Bodhidharma's death here contains this incredible, this is a terrific story. So after transmitting the mind seal of succession to Hui Ke, Bodhidharma is described having either returned to India or as having been poisoned by jealous rival teachers. One skillful account of his death incorporates both. His work in China complete, Bodhidharma is said to have made no attempt to resist a sixth attempt by his enemies to poison him. Sitting in an upright position, he passed away. The legend then relates that 3 years later, a Dharma seeker named Song Yun, who was returning from a trip to India, encountered Bodhidharma walking in the Himalayas, carrying one sandal. When Song Yun asked the master where he was going, he replied, "To India." Song Yun returned to China and reported this event to the new emperor, Shao Sheng. Thereupon, Bodhidharma's grave was opened and his body was discovered missing, with only one sandal remaining in the crypt. That's the story. According to tradition, upon Bodhidharma's death, Emperor Wu honored him with the posthumous name Zen Master, Holy Transcendent. And later, a Tang Dynasty emperor honored Bodhidharma with the additional title Great Teacher, Perfect Enlightenment. So John McRae finishes up this whole thing. He said, in a nutshell, the legend of Bodhidharma, as it has been passed down within the Chan tradition, that's Chinese Zen. Chan is Chinese Zen. There can be no doubt of its utility as a coherent distillation of classical Chan doctrine. Bodhidharma, the enlightened but iconoclastic master, transmits the true teachings of Buddhism to China, where until his time, it had only been understood in a superficial and self-seeking manner. The 9 years of facing a wall at Shaolin Temple and the implicit demand of Hui Ke to stand in the snow all night imply a disregard for conventional reputations of Buddhism and the demand that students spare no effort or personal sacrifice in order to achieve enlightenment. John McRae says, how many times this story must have been told in meditations in China, Korea, Japan, and now America and Europe, in order to spur practitioners on to greater effort. Both these stories about sitting 9 years facing a wall and Huike standing in the snow all night, these stories have been told again and again all over the world. And this also, the dialogue, it's called the Pacification of Mind Dialogue, the one about his four disciples, and each one having a different answer, a different understanding of reality. John McRae says, this is an archetypal example of Chan or Zen spiritual training itself, which is less an individual endeavor than an interactive event, the interpersonal encounter between master and student set in a genealogical context. The attacks on Bodhidharma served to highlight the unique status he held as sole transmitter of the true teachings and the autonomous control he had over his death and subsequent return to his native land. Those add an occult aura to his extraordinary capabilities. Indeed, the account of Bodhidharma, McRae says, represents a highly integrated distillation of the Chan or Zen message. And as such, it has been among the most treasured subjects of Chan's sermons and dialogues over the centuries. But the story is not true. The image of Bodhidharma that has been transmitted to us as a result of long hagiographical or adulatory process, it is not biographical in the sense of being an accurate depiction of a man's life. Rather, it's an idealized image of a sage, the human demonstration of enlightened charisma, the life of an Indian saint on Chinese soil. And he concludes by saying that this hagiography is a particularly good example of the fluidity of legendary Chan imagery. I think, and now this is, this final point is really important. He says that if we look at the matter more closely, we would see that the evolution of Bodhidharma's image, the evolution of his image, functions as an index to the evolution of Zen itself, of Chan itself. That is, if we do an analytical cross-section at different points in time, we would see that the members of the Chan school were reformulating Bodhidharma's identity to fit their own conceptions of religious sagehood in each particular age. So each subsequent configuration implies a change in the religious identity of Chinese Chan. So it's a dynamic process that continues to the present. He says that in 1992, a Taiwanese movie account of Bodhidharma's life shows him not only sitting rock solid in meditation, a full 9 years without moving a muscle, but also as a miraculously gifted martial artist, catching arrows in his teeth and flying through the air. The modern martial arts cinema tradition has remade the image of Bodhidharma according to its own needs, just as medieval Chan tradition did. The results are different, but the process is basically unchanged. So that's what John McRae concludes. Each age reconfigures the image of Bodhidharma in terms of its own what it wants to see to inspire them. And so he's catching arrows with his teeth, and he's sitting 9 years without moving a muscle and so forth. So, all right. Here, I think, are the most important points. First, the Bodhidharma, to just to remember that he's the first patriarch of Soto Zen Buddhism, and that he brought the Bodhisattva precept lineage from India to China. That's one very important point. Secondly, the Dharma must not be listened to casually. It is a vital, unsurpassable, and deserves our entire single-minded, wholehearted attention. Not just deserves, but it must have our entire single-minded, wholehearted attention, or we miss the sweetness of its subtlety. And third, the Buddha Dharma has its own methods for penetrating thick human body minds. Like face creams, it soaks in best while we sleep. That means you don't have to strain to understand things at all. Just let this talk float through you, sort of. The fourth important point is not true means more important. Not true means more important because it inspires practice. And everything we're talking about is about our practice. And these legends inspire practice and have for centuries. And that's why they're more important. If we had this, you know, droning on true story of the history of, you know, Bodhidharma's life, it wouldn't be near as inspiring. It would be boring, probably. We don't have it, but it would be boring anyway. Sort of. Not as inspiring as he was seen walking to India with one sandal, and then it was discovered that his coffin was empty except for one sandal. I don't think I'll ever forget that one. And then the last point, if we could do an analytical cross section of all of these stories, we would just see that each generation reconfigured the Bodhidharma story to suit their own ideals. Well, these were mainly stories, but I have a few ideas for how you can personally reflect during the week. First, one of the reasons why the Dharma should be listened to with your whole being is that it isn't meant to be collected like knowledge. It contains teachings that actually we can't grasp with our minds. And if you listen to the Dharma with your body, especially in the Zazen posture, it will penetrate according to your capacity to receive. And you don't need to think about it anymore. And if you've had this experience, you'll understand. And if you haven't, this is just words. But if you haven't, you might just notice, and next time, listen in the spirit of allowing the words to simply float through you. So if you haven't had this experience of allowing the words to simply float through you by just sitting, even in the Zazen posture or something simulating that, please try it. It's a different way of receiving the Dharma. And another idea is you can use your what you notice about yourself as you're listening to the to a Dharma talk, what you notice about yourself, you can use that as a kind of index of the level of the settledness of your mind. I mean, I'm aware that we live in a culture that simply doesn't stop. There's constant activity and drumming speed. And we all take this in sometimes as a prerogative, you know, we should be doing this. And if you notice the quality of your mind as you're listening to a Dharma talk, you can see how much you've personally been affected by this subconscious agitation. According to the story, Bodhidharma sat near Shaolin Temple for 9 years. And he sat separately from the temple so that he could sit. The temple was engaged in everything but kind of zazen. So the idea is to inspire you to practice zazen. And I want to say that I hope that you do this, that you take these stories to inspire you to whatever you're doing, maybe do a tiny bit more. Just like one beat faster, which my banjo teacher tells me, if I'm practicing something and I can just move it up one beat a day or something like that. So that's kind of what I'm suggesting for your zazen practice. And then if you're among those who find it easier to listen to teachings rather than practicing them, why don't you take the practice of mindfulness and notice yourself when you're doing this? So for example, I right now, this is I as being one of you, am reading about Buddhism or listening to Dharma talks as I avoid sitting zazen, the main event of Zen. And the point being that in zazen, we neither learn anything nor get anything. And in reading and listening, we do both. So just reflect on this fact that if you're one of those who easily listen or read and take in and get things, that you avoid doing practices where you get nothing and learn nothing. And just notice, that's all. Just notice. Without judgment, just notice. I wonder if you have any questions.
Thank you, Gail. The first question that we have is, could you say why Zazen is considered so important for Zen practice?
I'm really glad you asked, because everyone, I think, wonders about this. First of all, in the Soto Zen lineage, the teachings have been passed down face to face, one to one, mind to mind, in a transmission all the way from Shakyamuni Buddha to Huike to the third patriarch to the fourth patriarch, etc., down to today. And each and every ancestor, each and every one of them, attained enlightenment by doing Zazen. And secondly, Dogen says that every single precept is included in Zazen, and that you can skip everything. You can skip confession and regretting. You can skip chanting sutras. You can skip studying sutras. You can skip bowing. You can skip incense. You can skip everything, because it's all included in Zazen. And again, Zazen, there's nothing to attain and nothing to learn. So it's a completely pure practice. That's a no gain. There's no gain. And then in the no gain, it's stating that that there's no self to gain anything. And so it's consistent with reality. It's consistent with the truth that we actually don't exist as independent individual selves who have nothing to gain. If we don't have an individual self, there's no self to gain something. I'm sure there's more, but that's what comes to mind right now. The main one is the first one, that every single ancestor, without exception, has attained enlightenment through this practice of Zazen. Again, thank you. It's a really important question.
That's all. Thank you, Gail. So the next question that we have is, what do you mean exactly when you say to listen to this or other Dharma talks with single-minded attention, allowing the words of the talk simply to flow through you? Could you be more specific?
Yes. I'm remembering when I used to participate, I think it was every Wednesday morning, in Dharma talks by, this is when I was a Tibetan, practicing Tibetan Buddhism, Dharma talks by Lama Paldin, she lives in San Rafael. And sat in a chair with a little like podium before her, and she always brought her dog, and her dog sat on the floor right beside her on the floor with its face kind of on the floor, and every single muscle of its body was attuned to every single muscle in her body. Like if she would move to adjust the mic, you could see it would just kind of perk up for a second. Or if she got a piece of Kleenex, it would perk up for a second. And then it would just go back to having its face on the floor. And it was almost like her, this dog was almost like her attendant. And I thought to myself, this dog who accompanies her everywhere and listens to all of her talks, it hears the Dharma constantly. For sure, in its next lifetime, it will attain enlightenment. It will be reborn as a human and attain enlightenment. It has gotten so much Dharma in its life as a dog. That's what I mean. Listen as if you were Lama Paulden's dog. Exactly. I don't want to say anymore. That's how you should listen to Dharma talks. This dog was a perfect example. I'm not sure it was a he or she or they. Thank you.
Gil, the next question we have is, there are so many human beings on this planet. In fact, too many. It's hard to believe that a human incarnation is as rare as a turtle in the ocean and so forth. I feel rather that the universe is swarming with them. It's very hard to believe that we are so rare.
I know. What I'm aware of is, you can drive down the street or walk down the street and you see these faces. And so many of them even just don't have a depth of consciousness. And you almost wonder, how did they get to be human beings? But they must have had very good karma from a previous lifetime. But the point is that you can't count on that happening again. It's very definitely said in Buddhism that when you attain a human incarnation, you won't necessarily attain a human incarnation next lifetime. And if you don't behave properly, really, if you don't merit that incarnation, you may never attain a human incarnation ever again. And therefore, it's really important how we behave, especially how we behave in interaction with others. All we can do is our best. But we don't want to be reborn as an ant or a Bodhidharma's wife, as a snake. So we have to be careful. Thank you.
Thank you, Gil. So we're left with two questions. I'll just share both the questions with you. And then you can see if you can answer them maybe together. So the first one is, so we don't have any control over how we will be reborn. Is that right? And the second one is, the idea of incarnation is so controversial. I'm surprised it is so big in Buddhism. It makes Buddhism a little sketchy, like too out there or something.
We definitely do have control, a certain amount of control, because of our behavior. We have control over our behavior. And I think the connection between these two questions is that basically, the whole idea of incarnation, the reason that in Buddhism it's actually heretical not to believe in previous and future lifetimes, because Buddhism is the bedrock of Buddhism is cause, the idea of cause and effect. Whenever there's an effect, like you, we're like, I'm an effect. And because there's an effect, there's a cause. There's a cause for every effect. That's why there's no God in Buddhism. There's no cause for God. So there's no God, because everything in Buddhism, everything that is in effect has a cause. And so that explains why incarnation, the idea of incarnation, is taken very seriously, because I found it very relieving when I first heard about it, because it meant that good things that I do in this lifetime will be taken up again in later lifetimes. And it's not just a waste, sort of. The thing that really made the big difference for me coming to totally accept the idea of incarnation is I read the Dalai Lama wrote a book in detail describing his previous 13 incarnations. The Dalai Lama is the 14th Dalai Lama. And so he had 13 previous incarnations as the Dalai Lama. And he describes them in terrific detail. And when I read that, I just thought, oh, well, this is the Dalai Lama. I mean, I totally trust the Dalai Lama. And here he is talking about his 13 previous incarnations. So that changed me completely. But I see we have to stop. And before we do, I want to thank my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan. And I want to thank you all for attending. So I thank you so much. And I want to thank the people who aren't here today, but listen faithfully to the talks during the week. And I also want to thank Rebecca Green, who tells me how to pronounce Japanese, Chinese, and Sanskrit words when I send them to her in advance. And then she tells me, this is how you pronounce them. So presumably I'm pronouncing them correctly. I mean, she definitely gives me the correct pronunciation, but sometimes I can't always do it. So thank you very much. I'm very excited about this series, and I hope to see you next time, next week. Bye-bye.